See, it's rather nice, this thought of language playing such a part in the third period of Soul, isn't it? Because language is really the means whereby understanding becomes definite, doesn't it? It's the means whereby we can communicate with each other and understand one another definitely. And we're just going to quote where in Science and Health Mrs. Eddy cites these four world languages. Do you remember on page 23 it is Hebrew, Greek, Latin and English. It's a wonderful order because you see Hebrew is the language of the Old Testament, the Word, Greek, the language of the New Testament, the Christ, and Latin, for a long time, the language of the Christian Church, Christianity, and English, of course, the original language of Christian Science. Of those four, Greek, Latin, and English apparently derive closely from the Sanskrit of the third period, Aryans, while Hebrew is the language of the third period, Hebrews. So there's the four of them. Now, as we look at, just for a moment again, look at this third period as a whole, it's the great migratory period, and you see at the beginning the Hebrews migrating to their homeland in the Middle East, and you see the Indo-Europeans migrating all over the place and overturning and changing resident societies as they do that. Now, In the process of that, and new societies come to birth, and old societies, some of them, end. So let's just come to the way in which the period closes, because you have again now two major new societies forming, and one, to use Toynbee's words, is the Syriac society in the Middle East. That's a new major civilization, which includes the Hebrews. See, that society is a bit huge, of course, as a civilization in its own right, and it includes the Hebrews, it includes the Babylonians, and lots of others besides. And also, there's a new major Hellenic society has begun to take root in Greece, and that is directly connected with the original Minoan society. So can you see the period ending almost in parallel with the way it began, with the Hebrews and the Indo-Europeans, and at the end the Syriac society that includes the Hebrews and the Hellenic society on the Greek mainland. Now, the interesting thing is, you see, it's the Soul period, and it's the period, therefore, of identity. And from the Hebrews, right there in the center, is going to come Jesus, the manhood idea. And from the Aryans, from the, as they develop the Hellenic society, and that carries on through to the Western Christian society, is going to come Christian Science, the womanhood. So it's quite extraordinary, I think, that at this point you get a hint of the eventual identity of the manhood and womanhood of God. I find it quite wonderful when I really can get my thought big enough to see that in the Bible, at this point, the corresponding pair are Judah and Joseph, aren't they? The manhood and womanhood. And you're far as you and I are concerned, we are identifying ourselves here with the first two periods, where the manhood and the womanhood are hinted at least, more than hinted at really, but they now begin to have specific identity. And if we see that, then we can come forward now without a break into the fourth period. You can see, can't you, that what we call the fourth period is the first millennium BC. I think we did this last time. From 1000 BC to the birth of Jesus. And can you picture it now then? Can you picture the whole wonderful panorama that the Greek civilization, the Hellenic civilization, has begun to mature in Greece? And it's the Greeks of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. He's produced the myths of the Iliad and Odyssey, and it seems to be such a feature in forming and developing the Greek civilization. Toynbee just goes overboard about the Greeks. He says the Greeks are really the first really free thinkers in civilization, in the history of civilization. You see, it's this great pivotal period we are in now. You see it, don't you? Right in the middle, the pivotal, the fulcrum period on which the whole thing is doing this. And it's called, of course, the Classical Age. It's going to come through to, at the end, it's going to come through to the Roman Empire and going to be called the Greco-Roman civilization. And as such, we must see this. It becomes, if you can just visualize it, it becomes the intellectual cradle of the whole world civilization of the fifth and sixth periods. It would have to, you see, being right there in the middle of the development. And where we said right at the beginning that you got this spirit of inquiry asserting itself, and that's what really started the whole thing moving. In the Greek civilization, there's this deep-seated spirit of inquiry which dominates the Greek character, so that it gives rise to quite unprecedented advances in science, in philosophy, systems of democratic government. You see, there's the tone of principle coming, because the Greeks introduce democratic government as no other society ever has. And in respect of that democratic government, what you get so interestingly is the Greek city-state. You see, the Greek city-state is an individual city-state that, being democratically run, is a sort of preliminary symbol of the eventual world city-state of the city four square. The Greek city-state is introduced at this point, which is so interesting. But the thing about it is that each city-state is individual, and as such, it fails to unite, the idea fails to unite the nation. They're not able to come together as a diversity in unity. And therefore, you get them warring against each other. And the principal, two principal warring states are, of course, Athens and Sparta. And it's so interesting just to look at Athens and Sparta in view of the fact that the whole period is the cradle of what is to come in the Western Christian and in world civilization subsequently. Now, Athens is an industrialized, sea-oriented democracy where a form of capitalism reigns, while Sparta is a militarized, land-oriented autocracy where a form of socialism reigns. In Athens, the individual is sacrosanct. In the case of Sparta, individuality is subservient to the collective mass. Well, how about the seeds of the present world civilization and the division of the world into East and West seems to have its seeds sown at that point in the principle of the fourth period. Now, it's just as if you can visualize the world thing. It's as if the world is roughly divided into three sort of spheres of activity. There's the Greeks dominant in the West with their science, their philosophy, their reason, their logic, and all that. Whereas in the East, that's in India and Persia and China, religion is dominant. Science, religion. Scientific thinking with the Greeks and religious mysticism dominant in India, Persia, and China. Now, if you can see those two, seeing it in very broad general terms, of course, but that's how we need to keep our thought at this moment. Otherwise, we're going to miss the picture if we get bogged down in detail. You see, now right in the middle is dear little Israel, and Israel with her God-inspired prophets. Can you see her forming a sort of bridge? Because out of Israel is going to come eventually the unity of science and religion. So she's forming a lovely sort of bridge there. And it's what is said to be a great creative epoch flourishing everywhere in the world. You'd expect it if the tone is principle and if it's the fulcrum period of the whole development, wouldn't you? And so you get Gautama the Buddha arising in India, Zoroaster in Persia, you get Lao Tzu and Confucius in Far Eastern China, whereas he's a terrific crop of intellect, unprecedented. And in the Middle East, of course, you get the prophets of Israel, the necromancers of Babylon. But in Greece, the scientists, the philosophers, the statesmen, the mathematicians. Don't need to mention them, do we? Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Pythagoras, Sophocles. No end to them. And it's so worth realizing, isn't it, that out of this tremendous output, intellectual output of the Greeks, you're going to get these such concepts as principle occurring, such concepts as idea, logos, logic, reason. Therefore, the term word is going to feature. So no wonder, what Toynbee says of the Greek society is that it is the finest flower of the species that has ever yet come to bloom. Isn't that nice? Well, just think of that, the idea of principle, the idea of idea, the idea of logos and reason and all that. You see, it's utterly, utterly impersonal. They are impersonal ideas, aren't they? And therefore, what the panorama, the total context, what it demands is that these Greek ideas shall not be parochially confined, because at the moment they're parochially confined to Greece. And yet they are so impersonal that they apply impersonally to man. And therefore it's essential that they find their way to the rest of mankind. And this begins to happen through Alexander the Great. Alexander is in the period known as the Hellenic Age. Alexander becomes the first world conqueror. And as he conquers and conquers and conquers, so the Greek civilization spreads and spreads and permeates wherever he goes, wherever the conquest takes him. Because his ideal is to form a world society based on Greek culture. Yes, but he fails. He fails in his bid for world unity, world peace, world security, whereas, as the period develops and you come near to the close and Rome becomes the dominant factor, it is that the Roman Caesar is going to succeed where Alexander fails. It'll all be part of one idea, one picture, because it's all going to be called, in the end, the Greco-Roman civilization. But Caesar is going to succeed in unifying the world, and you're going to get the jolly old Pax Romana and all that. You know, the whole civilized world is going to be under the umbrella of Rome. Not quite. We'll speak to that in just a moment. Now, this is so interesting, you see. Can you see this about the Greeks and what they're doing with their science, with their impersonal science, their quite impersonal principle that applies to all the world? Because in a moment, as we enter the fifth period out of this fourth period, of course is going to come Jesus. And Jesus is going to teach and preach and present the Christ idea. And it'll look as if it's a religious happening, all about God the Father and whatnot. But if it's just a religious happening, it's not going to be of any value or much value to the rest of mankind. Can you follow this happening? So what's going to take place is that Jesus's beloved disciple John, who is going to be the author of the fourth gospel, which is the science gospel, isn't it? And the author of the book of Revelation, which is anticipating the coming of science itself, so he really is standing for science. What John is going to do, and you see it immediately, you begin to read this gospel, you see him explaining or using Greek ideas, impersonal scientific ideas, to impart Jesus's religious truths. And so, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and so on and so on. But it's lovely to see how the two are going to be brought together in that way, the science and the religion. Follow that? Is that all right? Now, we can't leave the period until we have had a good look at the Middle East and the fortunes of the Kingdom of Israel, because Israel is absolutely focal to the whole happening, isn't it? Well, all is well with Israel under King David, the United Kingdom, and as such is God's kingdom on earth. But as soon as Solomon builds that temple, the rot sets in, because they start to worship the symbol instead of worshiping the idea, and therefore worshiping the principle of the idea. If they worship the symbol, they haven't even got a symbol any longer, they haven't got an idea any longer, they haven't got a principle any longer. What they got is a counterfeit. And that's a material organization. No doubt about that. So, you get, therefore, David's United Kingdom splitting into the two warring kingdoms of Israel under the house of Joseph in the north, and Judah under the house of Judah in the south. Right? Yes. And, of course, Israel has rebelled against the authoritarianism of Judah. And the general picture in the area becomes the dominated by Assyria. Assyria dominates, conquers and dominates, and takes the kingdom of Israel into captivity and disperses her amongst the nations of the world. And it looks as if they combine with the European branches of the Indo-Europeans as they migrate further across to the west. Assyria, those are the 10 lost tribes, aren't they? So-called lost tribes. Then it is that Babylon takes over the area and pushes Assyria more or less out of the picture, and Babylon takes Judah into captivity for a period of 70 years. So it's a lovely center and circumference. You've got Judah standing for the center, the temple, and you've got the dispersed lost tribes of Israel dispersed among the nations of the world, constituting a sort of circumference to that center. We've got to see these things, otherwise we're not really following it spiritually. And you begin to see it much more clearly when you get into the fifth period. Well, then it is that Babylon surrenders to the Medes and Persians. Media-Persia liberates Judah from Babylon after a period of 70 years. And she returns, of course, Judah, to rebuild the temple and the city. Then comes, after Babylon, after Media-Persia, comes Greece, the Greece of Alexander the Great. And Alexander really begins to conquer and to conquer. And finally, the whole Mediterranean area comes under the control of Rome, and the Caesar is the god king. You're right on the brink, you see, of the first messianic advent, the coming of Jesus. And you know what Jesus stands for, and therefore the Caesar himself, who is the antithesis of Jesus, and the Roman Empire, the antithesis of the kingdom of heaven. What the Caesar is said to stand for is a god sent from heaven to liberate the world from destruction. Got that down somewhere. Yes. And so you arrive at this extraordinary situation of the Pax Romana, when the whole of the civilized world, as far as the West is concerned, becomes subservient to Rome. And now a curious thing has come to light, that of course the Far East is way off and out of reach. But the Far East, China, does exactly the same thing. It unifies its world under its emperor. And so you get these two unified world peace here, world peace there. But of course they're not united. There have to be eventually. So this is the vital thing, that unless you get this unified situation which Rome achieves, you're not going to get the soil, the environment for the first coming of the Christ idea, which is always a unitary idea, the Christ idea, isn't it? You see, Rome is going to unify the world, and into it is going to be born Jesus, the successor to the Greco-Roman society, which is going to be the Western Christian society, is after that, eventually in the sixth period, going to unify the world, and into that is going to be born Christian Science. You've got to have this situation before these two advents of the Christ idea can be manifest. Happy about that? Could you just turn to the idea of the city that is dominant to begin with, is of course Jerusalem, as far as Israel is concerned, and the negative of that is the harlot city Babylon. That yields at the end to still Jerusalem as the positive, the true idea of the world city, but the negative is going to become Rome. So it's Jerusalem versus Rome at the end, whereas it was Jerusalem versus Babylon at the beginning. And you know how, as the story continues and Rome develops into the papacy and so on, and the papacy is going to be identified as Babylon. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. You see, so we just pick it up for the moment at the point where Jerusalem is the positive idea of the great holy city. Holy city, and Rome, the negative holy city. Now, the extraordinary thing is that just as you see that with Jerusalem and Babylon, there aren't really two, not really, no. One is simply the supposititious opposite of the other. So it is in the case of Jerusalem and Rome. One is simply the supposititious opposite of the other. And you seem to see that when you, this is very interesting, I think, when you see the actual city plan on which the city is built. The plan upon which Rome is built is a center and a circumference. And the plan on which Jerusalem is built is again a center and a circumference. The center is the temple and the circumference are the walls with their gates, that's right. In the case of Rome, the center is something called the mundus, which means the world. And it's a deep under the ground, I don't know what, building of some sort, with a dome-like top outside, which is a dome is a mother, because it's the womb. The dome, the symbol of the dome. And what it says about this mundus, that it typifies the underworld. It's a subterranean storehouse from which everything grows and comes to birth. Of course, to you and me, we can see what it is. It's a symbol of the cosmic unconscious. Of course it is. Out of which radiates the whole of, apparently, human consciousness. Well, would you mind translating it? Because when you translate it, you see, you come at the end of the chapter, The Apocalypse in Science and Health, to these two views of the Holy City. And the first is the city four square, where you get everything radiating out from center. And the second view is called City of Our God, where the emphasis is on the circumference being drawn back to the center. You see that? And we haven't left it yet, because what they show and what Gustav Jung, Carl Jung shows, and I think Toynbee shows too, is that it's an entirely impersonal symbol. It isn't something that somebody's thought up, this plan. This city plan isn't something that somebody's thought up, because out of humanity's dreams and trances and reveries and hypnosis comes something called the mandala. You know the mandala? It's a mystical symbol that features largely in Buddhism and in Hinduism and comes to the surface in dreams and in the work of psychiatrists. Now, the mandala is basically formed of this square circle. What the mathematician tries to do is to square the circle. Now, when you look at the Holy City at the end of the Apocalypse chapter, what you see the metaphysician doing is to circle the square. And this is the mandala. It's an entirely impersonal figment of the imagination, but it's not something that somebody ever thought up. It's deep down in the so-called unconscious. All right, you see that? Now, will you translate that, please? If the deep down in the unconscious? Will you translate that into the mind which is God, and see the holy city coming down from God out of heaven? Because then you've got the positive, of which that is the negative. How are you doing, everybody? Can you see this? It's just a terrific thing of translation which is going on. You see, and all these happenings in the human picture are just this activity of translation taking place. You see, it's extraordinary, really, that in the course of the story you get four distinct cities featuring. And the first is Babylon, the second is Jerusalem, the third is Rome, and the fourth is Boston. And they are in the order of the word. That's Babylon taking Judah in the Old Testament into captivity. Jerusalem, the false sense of Jerusalem, of course. I don't mean the holy Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, but the Jerusalem that takes Jesus the Christ captive and entombs him. Babylon entombs Judah. Jerusalem entombs Jesus. Rome entombs Christianity. And Boston entombs science, in belief, all in belief. But the answer to that is one city, and it's the city of the Word, the Christ, Christianity, science, which doesn't entomb anything, because it's the whole world in a state of freedom and prosperity and all the rest of it. Well, I think from that we come to the fifth period. Should we do that? Did you get a feel of the fourth from that? Hope so. And as we come into the fifth period, you see you've left you come from your prophets, where the four major prophets form your fourfold center, and your 12 minor prophets form your 12-fold circumference, and you come to the fifth period, where your fourfold center, of course, becomes the four gospels. It's only the symbol moving forward into more developed form, same symbol, but moving forward into a more living form. And your 12-fold circumference becomes your whole civilized world. Because what's Paul going to do? He's going to take the gospel of the four gospels and radiate it out to the Roman Empire, right as far as Rome itself. And therefore he's going to be called the apostle to the Gentiles. Well, we've already talked about these tones of the fifth period and that fourfold center with the Gospels is, of course, life as mind. Life at the point of origin. Didn't you love that? Life at the point of origin. Life circulating from the Father to the Father, never leaving the Father. Life at the point of origin. Then when you come into the second tone, we've already talked about this, life as spirit, because of what Jesus has done, the whole world, born again. Absolutely. Because of what the center stands for, the whole circumference, born again. And that's represented by the descent of the Holy Ghost on the day of Pentecost and by the reception accorded it by representatives of every nation under heaven who were in Jerusalem at the time. Yes, this beautiful life of spirit tone with the Pentecost and the Acts of the Apostles, you see, and Paul with his missionary journeys taking the God idea out to the furthest reaches of the Roman Empire, right out to the capital city, Rome. All for the purpose, can you see this? All for the purpose that in the case of the epistles, the purpose of the epistles is to gather this world back to its center. That's why the Pauline epistles, you see, Paul's the one who's at work. He represents the apostle to the Gentiles. And he starts with his epistle to the Romans, because he's right out there on the circumference, you see. And gradually he gathers the world back to its center, because his final epistle is the Hebrews. So he's drawn, he represents the drawing of the world back to its center and back to the fourfold center of James, Peter, John, and Jude, who are resident in Jerusalem there. So you can see the beauty of the symbolism. Well, this life as spirit tone goes on and on for a long time through the early apostolic church, the church of what's called the early church fathers, those dear old boys who decide that only the four gospels are valid as we know them. They are there to quell heresies, because heresies start to crop up. But most importantly, you know what they're there for? Because the people, the Christians, are in such a state of despair and disappointment, because Jesus has said, I come back. You see, and they mistake it and think that Jesus as a person is coming back. And of course, he doesn't come. And therefore, the fathers have to help them get over this disappointment. And as this is going on, then Rome, the Roman emperors, start to persecute the Christians. We all know the story of the persecution of the Christians under the emperors. And it's interesting that Christianity's reception by Rome goes through four stages. First of all, it's persecuted outright. Secondly, it's accepted in amongst all the other pagan religions. Then it's accepted on a par, on a level, with the other pagan religions, until fourthly, it is accepted as the only legal religion of the whole Roman world, and therefore ostensibly of the world itself. What a thing that is. Because at that point, you see, you enter the third tone, life as soul. Because what Rome does, instead of liberating life as soul, is the liberation of life, the freeing of individuality. Mm-hmm. But when Rome absorbs Christendom into a religious organization, of course, it isn't freedom at all, it's absorption. And the tone then is the negative of life as soul. Well, think of poor old Constantine when he's the converted pagan emperor to become the first Christian emperor. And what on earth are we going to do about the pagans? what are we going to do about all the slave population of the Roman Empire that we gathered into the Roman net at the time of the initial conquests? What are we going to do about it? How are we going to placate the pagans? Well, the only thing we can possibly do is to paganize Christianity at the same time as we Christianize paganism. Let's put Christianity into pagan terminology. Don't let's use the original terminology of the day of Pentecost and Jesus and all that. Let's put it into pagan terminology and have all these rituals and whatnot. And that's what happens, you see. Now, there's a very nice statement about that by James Frazer in The Golden Bough. Do you all know The Golden Bough? Regarding these pagan rituals that Christianity now has to suffer. He says that these rituals, etc., mark the compromise which the church, in the hour of its triumph, see, it was such a triumph, apparently, that it should be the only legal religion of the empire. The church, in the hour of its triumph, was compelled to make with its vanquished, all the pagan religions are vanquished by Christianity, but still dangerous rivals. Was compelled to make with its vanquished but still dangerous rivals by relaxing the too rigid principles of the founder, by widening a little the narrow gate that leads to salvation. If you had your textbook open at the fifth day of creation and the third tone of Life as Soul, you'd see at that point how the deific, it says there, the deific prerogatives are usurped. Remember that in that text? That it usurps the deific, Moramind usurps the deific prerogatives, is an attempted infringement on infinity. Precisely what's going on in the Roman world at that point. Well, here is the very interesting thing. Why on earth was there this Roman Empire anyhow? Well, it must have had a purpose behind it, and ultimately, that purpose is a divine purpose. So what you see is that at this point, it served its purpose. It can disappear. The Roman Empire has given way to Christendom, has yielded to Christendom. And the Roman Empire as such can pack up. A worldwide Christendom is about to supplant it. And therefore, the empire begins to disintegrate, and at the same time, Christendom begins to multiply. As the one disintegrates, the other multiplies. And possibly, wouldn't you think, one of the greatest, most momentous events in the whole story of civilization comes to pass. And it's this. You see, the empire has begun to become corrupt internally. And if you and I become corrupt internally, we lay ourselves open to the external infiltration of animal magnetism, and that's it. Now, the empire has begun to disintegrate through corruption internally, and that opens the door for the so-called barbarians from the north to come in and seem to administer the death blow. Now, Constantine, he's the emperor, it's all happening at this point of the conversion to Christianity, and Constantine, what he does is this tremendous happening. He shifts the seat of government from Rome in the west to Byzantium in the east. And as he does that, he renames Byzantium Constantinople. And so on the shores of the Bosphorus there, this great city of Byzantium becomes Constantinople. And that's where the seat of government now is, in the east. And there, government, the seat of government, or politics, are dominant over religion. Whereas in the west, the papacy grows under the Bishop of Rome, who is then called the Pope, and there it is that religion is dominant over politics. It's essential, really, to see this, because here is the empire having divided into east and west, and Christendom itself has divided into east and west. And Eastern Christendom is going to be known as Byzantine Orthodoxy, and Western Christendom is going to be known as Roman Catholicism. That's the name given to the to Christianity in its now divided state. See, always you're going to get division taking place. Yes, let's see, just a minute. But I don't know whether you can see, if your thought is able to branch out, as we'll try to do now, towards the present day, the world present day, you see there the seeds of the east-west split. We leave that for the moment. Now, it's in the west that the west, Rome, this papacy situation is such that the whole of the western world sinks under the torpor of a religious superstition such as never been known before. And you're into your fourth tone, your life as principle, you're beginning your Middle Ages in historical terms, and they begin with the Dark Ages, so-called. Not all that dark, except that it's a period of intellectual torpor, because superstition takes over to such an extent. And it's where monasticism begins. This is extraordinary. Can you see these? You see, you're in the tone of life as principle. Can you see these nuns and these monks hiding themselves off in little cells? Nuns think they're going to marry Jesus, and the monks, I suppose, think they're going to be one with God. It's exactly the opposite of life as principle. And what do? They literally take the veil. Now, if you had your textbook open at the point of life as principle, you'd find the text telling you that the veil is lifted. and the scene shifts into light. But in early Middle Ages, they take the veil, and instead of the scene shifting into light, it shifts into the Dark Ages. Isn't that extraordinary? And what comes very much into prominence is something called the cult of the Virgin. You know the cult of the Virgin at this point. I got a note about her here. Ever seen this before? You have. Haven't got it. Thought I had it marked, but I don't seem to. Yes, I have. Yes. It says here, significantly, an outstanding feature of the Roman Church in these early Middle Ages is the growing worship of the Virgin Mary. They developed accordingly what is called the cult of the Virgin. Can you see the Middle Ages becoming a sort of womb-like situation for the birth of Western civilization? The worship of the cult of the Virgin. People adored the image of her supernatural sanctity and her serene and tender solicitude for their salvation. Greatly did this contrast with their own dark fears of the imminence of hell and torments of the devil, which they were taught would assail them if they disobeyed the church. You see, that's why they loved the Virgin and her serenity so much. Anyway, this is what crops up into Western consciousness at this point. Well, now something's got to happen. This dreamy absentness and deep superstition, something's got to happen as the counter to it, and of course it does. That's in the West, and it does in the East, because it's the rise of Islam. Islam rises in the East as the counter to religious superstition and all that's going on in the West. And Islam, Mohammedanism, means submit to Allah or die by the sword. Now, interestingly enough, you see, Islam is said to be the final revelation of truth. Claims to be the final revelation of truth. And it claims that this final revelation of truth is recorded in a sacred book called the Quran. Now, it isn't too long, it is a long time really, but in the sixth period, you see, Christian Science is going to be the final revelation of truth in the right sense, and its sacred book is of course, Science and Health. And Islam is the great protagonist of Christianity in these early Middle Ages, whereas later on, communism is going to be the protagonist of Christianity, much later on. And they're both going to be messianic in their outlook, and they're both going to have sacred books. Karl Marx is going to be the sacred book of communism, as the Quran is of Islam. And it's all going to be resolved eventually and find its answer in Science and Health of Christian Science. What we're doing, you see, is to try, supposing you had a great big canvas, you know today how the artist has a huge canvas and he has huge brushes and great big pots of paint, and he will use these huge brushes to make great sweeping color masses and so on. It's a little bit what we're trying to do here. Well, Islam spreads like wildfire, and the Bedouin peoples respond to it so much. And it spreads in both directions, east and west. Now, what does it do? In the east, it spreads all over the eastern section of the old Roman Empire, including the Holy Land. Oh boy, the Holy Land falls to the infidels. And whereas Islam conquers the east, it fails to conquer the west. It gets as far as Tours, forgotten the date, and then is halted in the west, but it conquers the east. Now, you'd expect it, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you expect it that at this point the state of Russia comes into the picture? Well, it does. And it comes into the picture because Scandinavians want to enlarge their borders and they migrate across to that part of Eastern Europe, and they call the people Slavs, which just means slaves, and they overwhelm the Slav population, and the state of Russia is born, and immediately the Greek Orthodoxy in the east there, the Byzantine Orthodox priests and people come over and convert the primitive Slavs to Christianity, to Orthodoxy, and you get the beginnings of Russian Orthodoxies, or terribly important if you want to really follow the picture and get your thought in context. Because, you see, what must not happen is that Orthodoxy should be submerged. And when Islam conquers the homelands of Eastern Orthodoxy, the Orthodox religion is preserved because it's shipped to Russia. Now, by the time communism conquers Russia, the original homelands of Orthodoxy are freed from the Turks, freed from Islam. And Orthodoxy reasserts itself. So that it just is untouched. I don't know if you can follow that. And first of all, it's shipped to Russia for safekeeping, and then it's shipped back to its original homeland for safekeeping, because it must be preserved. Yes, the Islam keeps alive the intellectual fires of the old Greek civilization. Yes, she certainly does. Until that finds its way also into the West. Now, what you have to see, I think this is logical, the fifth period is coming to a close, and what you have to see is that in the world, setting the stage for the sixth period are now seven principal civilized societies and four principal higher religions. And as soon as that happens, the stage is set for the sixth period. And at that point, we just stop for a moment, turn the tape over, and start again on the other side. How about that?